Okay, at this time we begin the TechNet. I'm K2 Romeo in your whiskey. My name is Dick. And at this time, we do as we've done for the last 34 years, something like that, say 1982. That's 36 years. This will be TechNet 1708 of the series that began way back in September 82. As you guys have heard me say so often, the main purpose of the TechNet is to gather curious radio amateurs who want to know more about wireless equipment, the radio science in particular, and occasionally science and space also. We cover those subjects. Let me drop. There are 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. There are, in my opinion, more than 5,000 kinds of antennas. There are more than 10 kinds of transmission lines. Way back in the early days of the early 1900s, a ham radio operator connected his transmitter directly to the antenna. He operated from the attic of his house. He ran one wire out the north window and one wire out the south window and put the transmitter in the middle of the dipole. And eventually we located our ham radio station in lower levels of the house with the antenna still up high, and so he had to connect the two with a transmission line. And the coax cable, you'd be amazed how late that development was. Open wire line was used a lot earlier, so lots and lots of kinds of transmission lines, lots and lots of kinds of antennas, lots and lots of kinds of transmitters, receivers, methods of modulation, different kinds of ham radio. Let me drop. The reason I'm mentioning all that jazz is from time to time I hear somebody say, gee, I listened to that TechNet the other night, and I don't know what the hell those guys were talking about. That's a normal condition. When you're exposed to brand new material, you're going to be frustrated because you sense there's a lot more you don't know versus what you do know. And so just by sitting and listening and not becoming frustrated, you'll eventually find out what's going on. I remember in my freshman year in college, a fairly smart professor said, okay, this is the introductory class to the freshman class. This is your first year, your first day at the school. Look at that person in front of you. Look at that person to your left. Look at that person to your right. Only 25% of the people who are here are going to graduate from here. The other 75% are not. So those three people you looked at, most likely they will not be here when you graduate. Well, it didn't have to be that way. It's because they gave up for various reasons. So the fact that ham radio seems to be coming, don't let that trouble you. Okay, the way you sign into the TechNet is you're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a comment or a question. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 36 years, we believe somebody is listening. That hasn't have to be proven anymore. And the TechNet itself, let me drop.
Yes, you're a dick.
It's broken up into roughly three sections. The question and answer section where people sign in the beginning, followed usually by the science talk, followed by the space report by Paul S2N and science is AC2GS. So people who do have a question or a comment that want to sign in, wait for the beeps and please give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW listening. My name is Dick.
WH-Waller-YGO, yes.
I told you earlier, Joe, you're already signed in. Rich, we got you before before the machine timed out, N2EO. So we got Joe and Rich. Anyone else, please give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps.
Rich, Rachel, how are you? You're a dick.
Okay, one last call. Anyone else assigned into the TechNet? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
W2HL, Dick.
Okay, we're going to start off with Joe first. W2RYY. The man with his brand new Genie, I think it is, garage door opener. And so that failed piece of equipment is now back in operation. Let's hope it's still performing for you. You got it, Joe. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, last week you brought up a subject on a communication system that was used to rescue the kids in the Silent Cave, Silent, I think it's called, Thigh Cave, whatever Silent. And you said this works at 87 kilohertz. I'd like to hear more about this. It sounds like a fascinating type of subject to learn about that it can reach in so far using that particular low frequency of emission. WH-410Y, back to net.
I'm looking for my paper on that. Mr. Hay, I can't remember his call letters, is the guy who invented it, a British amateur who is now Silent Key. And he realized that a handy-talkie, a ham radio rig, a cell phone, all of them do not work in a cave when you're underground, and you're a fraction of a mile from the entrance of the cave. The RF just doesn't get down that that long, lossy dirt tunnel, if you know what I mean. The Hay phone, and by the way, if you just Google the words Hay phone, and in fact, all you have to do is go to QRZ.com, and when you sign into QRZ.com, they give you a whole bunch of interesting ham radio articles that are in the news right now, and the Hay phone is going to be described there. And then once you find the first one and you Google the word Hay phone, you'll find a whole lot of other articles. So on the net, on the internet, there's lots of ways you can read about this thing. Let me drop. But it is basically a resistive system. Let me describe that. If I started off with a very large sheet of conductive material, I got a great big rubber sheet. Let me give it some dimensions. I've got a sheet of rubber that's 5 feet wide and 5 feet long. And if I apply my digital voltmeter across the lower left-hand corner and the lower right-hand corner, I won't see anything. If in the upper left-hand corner and the upper right-hand corner, I connect two connectors, and I put a battery across them, what I'll be doing is setting up a voltage field across that conductive sheet, and so that I may be putting 10 volts across the upper two corners, and my digital voltmeter in the lower two corners maybe will register a fraction of a volt. But you'll see a voltage drop across this conductive sheet. Well, that's a two-dimensional model. Let me drop. The dirt that's in the vicinity of a cave is a three-dimensional resistive material. So by putting two probes in the earth inside that cave, I think they say they recommend it 20 meters apart. You put two probes in the ground 20 meters apart, connect them with two nice long wires over to your so-called transmitter. The transmitter is expressing RF voltage, single sideband, at 87 kilohertz sine wave frequency, 87 kilohertz of the center frequency, the carrier frequency. That frequency was chosen because similar equipment decades earlier had been using that frequency. So the new Hay phone decided to use the same frequency. So you're putting voltage across these two probes 20 feet apart, and a fraction of a mile away, outside the cave, you've got another two probes in the ground, 20 meters apart, and they're going to be picking up a weak signal. The signal they pick up is going to be 80 dB weaker, but with a good sensitive receiver at 87 kilohertz, you're going to hear what those guys are saying. So you can see that it's an unusual volumetric antenna, depending on the resistive characteristics of Earth. Let me drop. You can ask yourself the question, is the 87 kilohertz propagating through the ground as a real RF wave, or is it simply a resistive voltage drop across a conductive material? It's probably a mixture of both of those. But after some experimentation, Mr. Hay found out this works like a charm. So, an interesting experiment. I know that KC2WGB, John Beck, was experimenting by putting probes across various portions of his property and putting very sensitive amplifiers on it, and he could hear all kinds of signals created by subway stations and Con Edison and whatever. So all the currents that are flowing through the ground are giving you all kinds of signals. Let me drop.
You put a probe in your cock and one in your ass.
But because this thing is tuned to 87 kilohertz, it's rejecting all of those other frequencies, Joe. So it's only looking for frequencies, a couple of kilohertz above and below 87 kilohertz, and doing it with a very sensitive receiver, because single sideband can listen to very weak signals. So I wonder if that makes some more sense, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW in the tech band.
Stick a probe up your ass, Al.
It's an interesting subject to learn. But I'm also curious of, why did they pick upper sideband, and how did they get the modulation to work? Because you're talking about, say if sideband has a bandwidth on one side of 2 to 3 kilohertz, matter than...
You put a probe up your ass, Al, and one in your mouth. Stick a probe in your ass and put it in your mouth.
The circuitry to work...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Hey, don't worry, Joe. I'm hearing you very well on the input. I'm hearing everything you're saying. Many a single sideband transmitter starts off with a very low IF frequency. 10 kilohertz, 60 kilohertz, 10.7 megahertz, and whatever. And then by mixing techniques, it mixes up to the actual RF frequency you're putting output, which might be on 2 meters. So to generate a doubly balanced mixer, a single sideband generator, where you've got an 87 kilohertz local oscillator going into one port of the mixer, the IF port of the mixer gets the audio, the RF port then takes the output, which is going to be an upper and lower sideband of the 87 kilohertz, and by way of a bandpass filter, you select one over the other. And for because upper sideband is a little bit more popular than lower sideband with some receivers, they chose upper sideband. There's nothing magic about that. They could have chosen lower. But by choosing one of the sidebands with a filter after the doubly balanced mixer, they got a very sensitive system. So it's a very crafty technique. And so from inside that cave, a fraction of a mile away, there's almost no other way to communicate. Let me drop. When people heard about the fact that they were able to talk to those cave spelunkers or whatever they're going to call them, everyone assumed that it was a telephone circuit, that somebody ran a twisted pair in there. Because portions of that tunnel going into the cave go underwater in 3 or 4 places, and some of those places are extremely compact where a skinny person can just barely squeeze through, and particularly if you're now carrying an oxygen tank, you can see if they really had a twisted pair wire telephone system, you could easily get tangled in it, and that could become life-threatening. So the guys doing rescue were afraid to install real wire, but this wireless system at 87 kilohertz did the job very nicely. W2RYY for any further questions. K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
Yes, I do have another question. It relates to the bandwidth of this thing. Being that you're transmitting sideband, you have a shift where the energy is being transmitted higher than upper sideband. How do they get to keep the Q of the circuits working properly, or knowing that the Q of the circuits are very sharp because of the frequency involved, how are they able to maintain the same energy output over the Q? Carrier 800 kilohertz, they're putting out information maybe as high as 90 kilohertz. That's quite a shift down there as far as frequency spread, not like up on VS or USF where the Q circuits are much lower, so you can not have any kind of problem. Do you see what I'm saying?
If you're building yourself some LC filters, a filter that's made out of inductors and capacitors, Joe, and you were building it at 87 kilohertz as opposed to, let's say, 8.7 megahertz, it's a hell of a lot easier to build very low insertion loss, very high Q filters at 87 kilohertz. So it's a lot easier to build a filter there. Now, if you build the filter with 3, 4, or 5 poles, if you build the filter with just one pole, it's just going to have a very narrow band response if you don't load it very heavily. And to get good filtering, to pass the upper side band, reject the lower side band, reject the carrier, one simple Gaussian filter, it'll work, but it wouldn't be quite as clean. If you're willing to design a bandpass filter with 3 or 5 poles, and building poles at 87 kilohertz with L's and C's is very easy. So a 3, 4, or 5 pole filter, giving you a flat top response across 3 kilohertz, from 87 to 90 kilohertz, with good filter design, that's extremely easy to do. Over to you, Joe. I didn't say I'm skilled at doing it, but you go to a good filter synthesis book, like Mattai, Young, and Jones, or Zarev. Those are the two books that a lot of people use. You go to the right chapter in those books, it'll show you how to do it. W2RYY, K2RYW, the TechNet. Good questions, by the way.
Okay, the last part of the question is, how do you get the receiver to hear well down there? Because I thought your noise increases dramatically every octave you know. Is it like 6 dB increase in noise, relative noise? And that's very low in the frequency spectrum. They probably don't have a lot of things emitting noise down there, but I guess just maybe natural man-made noise would be a problem. What do you think the effective sensitivity of a receiver is down there, you know, using that kind of bandwidth?
Yeah, another good question, Joe. When it comes to an antenna, like a dipole, looking at the atmosphere, atmospheric noise increases 6 dB per octave as you go down, starting at a couple of dB of noise figure at, say, 100 megs, and it keeps increasing 6 dB per octave. That's an antenna looking at the atmosphere, where you're getting reflections off the ionosphere, where you're getting noise from the ionosphere with the solar wind in the ionosphere, and there's millions of lightning storms going on somewhere in the on the Earth. There's thousands, if not millions, of lightning storms going on continuously, and some of those lightning crashes are all being conducted by way of the ionosphere to that antenna in your backyard. That's an antenna looking at the sky. If you took that dipole antenna and slowly started sinking it 1 foot at a time under the ground, by the time you got a couple of feet under the ground, maybe 10 feet, you'd find out real fast the ground is an extremely big attenuator. It's a three-dimensional volumetric resistive material loading down your antenna. So more and more of that noise from the sky doesn't get through the ground into your antenna. Therefore, if your antenna is using the ground itself, let me drop it. With these two spikes in the ground, 20 meters apart, only the signals that penetrate the ground after it's lost from the sky are going to get to your receiving system at 87 kilohertz. Huge attenuation. So the amount of noise they see in the ground, a different kind of noise, but I'll bet you it's very quiet. And so what you're looking for is the resistor voltage drop across your receiving terminals a fraction of a mile away compared to the transmitting terminals of the people inside the gate. And by the way, it was a transceiver that can flip back and forth between transmitting and receiving, but the exact same kind of an antenna on both sides. So the fact that the ground is lossy helps you in this case, and the fact that you only have to go a couple of miles means that the resistor voltage drop across that chunk of ground is all you need to pick up the signal. You wouldn't be able to use this at 100 miles. A radio signal bouncing off the atmosphere at 100 miles by ground wave would work very well. But you try to do this through the ground transmission 100 miles, I guarantee you'd calculate a signal that's minus 800 dB, if you know what I mean. So because this is short range, resistive, and the sky noise is being attenuated, you put it all together, it works. 87 kilohertz is just a nice selective frequency where you've got a lot of rejection of 60 hertz and 400 hertz, the noise that's probably also in the ground, from somebody's power supply, like Con Ed and Loco and so on. So are you getting a little bit more of a feeling, Joe, as to how this can work and why it works so well? W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Yes, I am, Dick, W2RYY. It's fascinating to learn about new ways, new methods of communication, even though maybe it's new to me. I really haven't heard of that particular title. Subject before, hey phone. We'll have to Google it, read up about it, maybe have some more of my questions answered. Okay, very good. Thanks for entertaining the question. W2RYY.
Yeah, I do recommend you start off by going to QRZ.com and just look at all those introductory articles they're giving you, and the hey phone is one of them, or at least it was there last week, and I imagine it's still there. And you can Google the words, use your search engine for hey phone. And if I can think of the guy's call letters, I'll think of him in a minute. G3 blank 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 is the guy, Mr. Hay, who invented this thing. He's now a silent key, but again, you can Google those call letters. And by way of QRZ, or just Google those call letters directly as a search engine, and you'll get more information about this thing. There's three or four major articles on it that quite possibly Roy has already put it on his list. In fact, he has. I just took a look at the... If you go to roy@ac2gs.com, go to Roy, R-O-Y, at ac2gs.com, and he has a line of entry there where you click on it, and it'll tell you about the Hayphone. Let me check with Roy and see if I'm right on that one. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. It's not roy@ac2gs.com. That's an email address. The website is roy.ac2gs.com. And the gentleman's name was John Hay. He's Golf 3 Tango Delta Zulu. He invented it about 17 years ago. The British Cave Rescue Council provided that device to the Thai boys that were stuck in the cave. Before that, in the 1980s, they had something called the mole phone, which operated similarly, but not as well. And recently, they've opened to something called the Nikola Mark III as a caver communication. The problem with these communicators are that there's so little need for them that a commercial venture wouldn't profit. And so they're cobbled together and maintained by different cave rescue councils.
Now, one of the questions I expected Joe to ask, and I don't have an answer to it, is this is the modern version is transistorized, battery-operated. I'm guessing it only transmits a watt of power or something like that, so it doesn't have to require huge batteries. In your reading about this thing, Roy, did you get any impression as to how much power is transmitted? I think only a few volts needs to be put across the two probes on the transmitting side, because if you've got enough sensitivity on the receiver side, you only need a fraction of a microvolt to make it work. And between a few volts and a microvolt, that's 120 dB, if you know what I mean. So you can tolerate 120 dB of ground loss. That's a lot of loss. Therefore, with only a fraction of a mile, this thing's going to work. So I am guessing this thing only puts a fraction of a watt or a watt of power into the ground. What's your guess on that one, Roy? And thank you for correcting me on roy.ac2gs.com. Oh, well. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
No problem, Dick. One of the links on roy.ac2gs is a nice little two-page article on the Hayphone story, and it even shows you the newer Nikola system that's coming into vogue. It looks like a very small, low-powered device. I think it's meant to be very local and low power. This is not, we're not talking kilowatts here. We're talking a couple of watts, probably.
And those two probes on the ground, 20 meters apart, could easily have, let me pick a number, 100 ohms of resistance between the two, maybe even 10 ohms. And you put a couple of volts across 10 ohms, you're only putting milliwatts into the ground. And that's all you've got to do, because the receiver can receive microvolts, the transmitter is putting volts, and you've only got a fraction of a mile of distance between the two. So using the ground as a resistive material will get you that signal, even though radio doesn't propagate very well through ground. Let me drop. The nuclear submarines that the United States uses are communicated, they communicate with them at frequencies like 60 kilohertz. That's even lower than the 83 kilohertz that the Hayphone is using, something like 60 kilohertz. They drag a long piece of wire behind the submarine. The submarine can be up to 60 feet or I think 100 feet below sea water. And so a 60 kilohertz signal will propagate through the air, through the ionosphere, through the seawater, down to the submarine, and you can talk to the submarine with a very slow communication system. But that submarine doesn't have to come up to the surface. Anywhere in the world, that couple of megawatt transmitter they've got in Maine, among other places, they can communicate with the submarine. So when you go to a low enough frequency, you can propagate a radio signal even through seawater. I wonder if you've ever heard about that one, Joe. W2RYY for any further questions, comments, K2 K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, I forwarded you a picture or a diagram of a picture, maybe an artist's illustration or something like that. Maybe it was a live picture of the antenna system that is in Cutler, Maine. I have physically seen that antenna, and when I saw it, I didn't understand what it actually was until many, many years later when I actually come by this on the internet. But I have heard of that before, but I thought the subs don't use voice. I thought they use a form of CW or some sort of amplitude-changing method to be able to get the signal from point A to point B. Because I didn't think voice works down at 30 kilohertz and below 60-30 and stuff. I think that some of the subs I've seen, some of the sites have said they have frequencies as low as 16 kilohertz they use. I think voice would work on any of the frequencies anymore, you know, like the 87 kilohertz table. That's why I asked the question about it, because I thought voice modulation down on those frequencies is very difficult to produce, but maybe I'm wrong.
Once you're using a doubly balanced mixer as a single sideband synthesizer, whether you decide to send a tone for Morse code or whether you decide to do on-off keying of the carrier, or whether you decide to send voice, is very easy to generate a double sideband suppressed carrier, and then by filtering you decide which one of the sidebands you want. So sending voice at those low frequencies, very easy to do. The submarine communication, you're absolutely right, it is a kind of very slow Morse code, because they're using a receiver that is probably only 1 kilohertz or maybe 100 hertz wide to make sure they can listen to an extremely weak signal with high signal-to-noise ratio. So I never said that the submarines are using voice. In theory, if the submarine was very close to the main station, I know they could use voice, but they don't. And it's a block-encoded message. In other words, for all we know, five consecutive letters sent with just the right Morse code signature, so to speak, could be, we're at war now, go do plan number one, if you know what I mean. So, yes, they are using very slow speeds, Morse code, like signals, talking to the submarine. But it could be voice. The only reason they don't use voice is that the threshold would be much poorer. In other words, you need a signal that's 10 or 20 dB stronger to get sideband voice, as opposed to very slow speeds, Morse code. And they want to be able to talk anywhere in the world, under seawater, to that submarine, which might be 12,000 miles away, if you know what I mean. See how that makes a little bit more sense, Joe? And you're on the right idea there. The voice would be much more difficult. The B2RYY, B2RIW.
Okay, I'm starting to follow what you're talking about there. Continuing the question, over to the next guy.
Okay, Joe. Randy here from you. And come back again sometime. I'm having fun with him. Rich, N2EO. How are things in your neighborhood? You got it, Rich. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. N2EO. Dick, I want to make a follow-up on last week. You can go back and describe it to the people on tonight about what happened with the radio. But I thought it might be the finals. It's not. Andy, WHCDL, was over here last night, and he brought over a 2 meters, bird thermal line and a bird 43. He's very, very well equipped. He checked everything right down the line. He put bird thermal line on the Kenwood 590. It's putting out proper power, 100 watts, 160 through 10. And then he went right down the line, and I thought it was, like I said, it might be a fried ballon. He opened up the ballon because it sits on my wall, and it's made for inside use. And he took the screws out of the ballon. It looked fine. And then he found out The antenna tuner, which is a high-end, about $500, cost me. Made by a company called Calstar. Calstar. And what we found, or he found, he called me this evening because he opened it up today. He found that one of the tuning caps, it's a T network, was fried. One of the plates burnt off due to SWR, he thinks, in the antenna. So he's coming back this week to put an antenna analyzer on my antenna. And then this week I'm going to order a new capacitor. There are two of them in there. They'll probably be expensive.
Tell me the brand name and model number of your antenna. I know that Barry and I were, Barry did 98% of the installation, but I was there during the installation of your antenna. I think it's around 88 or so feet long, and I believe it works on 80 through 10 meters. Tell me the brand name and the model number of your antenna, Rich Grad, N2EO, K2IW. I think it's Cobra.
It's a Cobra. Get up. On the internet, the company name is Cobra Compact Antennas. If you Google that word, it'll come up. The first person who recommended it to me, I'd never heard of it before, was Gene, W2KJI, the KJI Electronics, and he stocks. They make three models. This is the in-between. It's 73 feet long, 80 through 10, and it feeds an open wire line to my Balun, and the Balun comes out, it's 4 to 1, and goes right to the tuner. Got it.
I've had some conversations with Andy already as to the measurements he made when he was at your house, and he has almost all the story. I've added a little bit to it. Here's what I think has happened. The antenna we've put up for you, the Cobra antenna, is strung between two trees. There's a tree in your front yard, there's a tree in your backyard, and about 40 feet in the air, there's a screw eye into the tree in both cases. The Cobra antenna, 73 feet long, ends with a egg insulator, and then it goes to a nylon piece of rope that I supplied, and the piece of rope goes through the screw eye and then comes down the tree, both on the north, both in the backyard and the front yard. So both ends of the dipole are suspended from the trees, and the rope comes down the tree and wraps around another nail, as I remember. And so that kind of an antenna installation is nice and simple, easy, but it's got a couple of vulnerabilities to it. Let me drop this. If you're a little bit unlucky with the way the wind blows so that the tree in the backyard sways to the north while the tree in the front yard sways to the south, then it could be overstretching the antenna and maybe creating a disconnect somewhere there. That's a possibility. On top of that, the open wire line is really a great big catenary from the hole in your house where the open wire line comes out of the house up to the antenna. So with the wind waving, fatigue failure of the open wire line, or maybe one end of the antenna or the other has come down and is laying on the ground. For whatever reason, the antenna is giving a very high standing wave ratio. Let me drop. One of the measurements that Andy made was to put close to 100 watts of power into your Balun in the house, which is at the 50 ohm point that normally goes to the transmitter. Put something like 100 watts into it. He saw 100 watts going forward through the Balun into the open wire line, into the antenna outside the house. 100 watts went forward and 60 watts came back. And after line loss, when you calculate what that really means, it's probably more than a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio. So that antenna used to work very well right now is giving you a high standing wave ratio. Let me drop. So the high standing wave ratio of the antenna could cause your transmitter, the Kenwood 590, I think it is, to go to a cutback mode and only put out 20 watts when it's running barefoot. When the transmitter is running into the amplifier, because the antenna has a very high standing wave ratio, you still have the ability to adjust the tuning and loading controls for the amplifier. However, where the antenna is so reactive and it's not absorbing much power, you get a lot of circulating power in the tank network of your antenna tuner. Therefore, the antenna tuner arced over, it's a C1 capacitor. It was a pi network. So the high voltage capacitor, the air variable capacitor, got arced over, and Andy found that some of those plates had actually been melted. So the arcing and sparking you were hearing was because the antenna was not giving a good load, a lot of circulating energy in the antenna tuner. The antenna tuner, I think, also contains your standing wave ratio indicator. And the standing wave ratio indicator is showing forward power. That diode is working correctly, but the other diode, which looks at reverse power, let me drop. That diode has been blown out. So as that capacitor arced over, it probably created a great big return voltage into that reverse standing wave ratio detecting antenna. And that's what blew it. That's why you're seeing no standing wave ratio at all. As we were saying last week, you had a very strong clue where every single band showed no VSWR. Nobody's antenna was that good. You get standing wave ratio. No reflective power at all. So the fact that you had no reflective power at all then tells you that something was not working correctly on that wave ratio detector. So you're on the way to amend, as I see it. Andy is going to take that capacitor that has damaged plates that are arcing and sparking and slightly melted and rubbing against each other, the air variable capacitor, the tuning capacitor of your antenna tuner. He's going to replace that capacitor. He's going to replace the diode that gives VSWR standing wave ratio detection. So your antenna tuner will be in operation. And we know darn well that you're a rugged thing. It's just a great big chunk of ferrite with a very large diameter wire with a Teflon insulation on it. To blow up a ballon, you thought that lightning had struck the ballon, and there'd be a great big char mark on the ground, on the wall where that's mounted, if you know what I mean. So most likely that's in great shape. So Andy was there at nighttime, and it was windy and raining, and he didn't get a chance to physically inspect your antenna. When he comes back during a bright sunny day and he looks at your antenna by, let me drop, by looking at the open wire line to make sure it's properly connected at both ends and the antenna itself to make sure that it's not laying one end of the where it's got a screw eye, so to speak. So as I see it, the original failure is an antenna failure, and that created all these other things when you tried pouring power into it. So you're on the way to amend, and it looks like pretty soon you'll be back on the air, as I see it, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS, do I have a question?
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Ultralight Junior, you know, 8210, 73 feet long, so that's probably the one. I wonder if that ladder line, I wonder, I'm trying to figure out what it's made of. I wonder if that's copper clad. You know, Dick?
What I think you're worried about is that the ladder line is made out of copper clad, which is really a kind of steel with copper on top. It cannot tolerate very much bending without getting fatigue failure. The way this compact 73-foot antenna is built with its loading coils and whatever, as I remember, it had a very nice strain relief mechanism right at the center of the dipole where the ladder line is attached. So I think you're worried about a fatigue failure at that point. And by way of the visual inspection, we'll know pretty soon when Andy comes back. So I think that's what you're concerned with, whether or not the stiff wire could be fatigue.
Yes, I've had that with sense, you know. Wire was, you know, the ladder line was steel copper clad, and like you said, but it wasn't up near the, you know, where it made a connection at the dipole. It was down, actually, right before it went into the house, you know, with all that moving around, with the, you know, blowing of the trees back and forth, that back and forth motion, right before it went into the house, it was right there. And it was weird because, you know, it created an intermittent problem, so it took a while to find it, but, you know. Okay, very good. Back to you there.
Back in the days when 300-ohm twin lead was the popular transmission line used on television aerials, we all used these standoff insulators. They made a fancy kind of standoff insulator, which was a great big screw eye with a big chunk of rubber in the middle of it, where the twin lead went through the middle of that rubber. So suspending your 300-ohm television twin lead in a whole lot of places as it ran along the roof and ran along the gutter and came down the side of the house, our 300-ohm twin lead was well supported along its length. Those things are not very popular. You don't see them anymore. Almost everybody who's using open wire transmission line these days sets it up as a great big catenary, a great big sagging piece of wire, which they're afraid to connect it to anything for fear that they interfere with its operation. There's all kinds of ways you could set up a standoff support for it. And you could also do it with tape. You could make a mechanism that suspends the open wire line with rubber tape, and that wouldn't disturb the impedance very much. Let me drop it.
AMC up a comment.
AMC recognized. So there's all kinds of ways we can suspend open wire lines so it's not one great big catenary waving in the breeze. But a lot of us do that. Over to you, sir. K2LIW listening. AMC, you got it.
Dick, in this month's QST, there was like an article about a ladder line where you can support it using pipe insulation. You put it inside the pipe insulation, it's a foam insulation, and that gives it enough separation from the environment so it'll operate properly. So check out this month's QST. There was a pretty neat article about it.
Now, you've used the word pipe insulation. I'm not sure what that means. Now, when it comes to open wire line, to feed it through a hole in the side of your house, I guess the average guy would put a great big piece of PVC pipe there, run the ladder line through the PVC pipe, and maybe support it with some kind of foam so it stays in the middle of that pipe. What do you mean by pipe insulation? Is it some kind of foam? Over to you, Mike.
Yeah, Rich. It's like a semi-rigid foam insulation, outer diameter maybe about 2 inches, inner diameter about 3/4 inches. It's split down the side so you could put a piece of pipe in it to insulate it from freezing. You could buy it at Home Depot. But if you go to this month's QST, that's where I kind of breezed through the article, but there's a whole big article about it this month. So check it out. Could be what you're thinking of, or, you know, what you could do as an alternative for open, ladder line.
Very glad you gave us those extra words. Now I remember what pipe insulation is. Yes, it's a kind of foam, split down one side, round, and you put it around water pipes, like the hot water pipe, so that it doesn't lose its heat. So it's thermal insulation, pipe insulation. At first I thought you were talking about some kind of electrical insulation with something going down an electrical conduit. So thermal insulation, yes, that's a very low density foam. It will have an extremely minor effect on the impedance of your open wire line. Open wire line, by the way, is very tolerant, as long as you don't lay it up against a piece of aluminum ductwork, if you know what I mean, or galvanized ductwork. As long as it's not flat against a piece of sheet metal, open wire line works very well in lots of environments. So, yep, that's a good way of going. So, this long piece of partially supported catenary of open wire line that goes to Rich's antenna, that needs inspection, and the antenna needs inspection. So on a nice sunny day, Andy will be able to see what's going on there, particularly if he brings along his binoculars. And by the time Barry, and 2MB comes back from the Carolinas and brings his ladder over there. He can climb back up on your roof and fix almost anything that has failed. So it looks like there's light at the end of the tunnel as I see it, Rich. N2EO, K2RAW in the tech net. I can tell somebody was trying to sign in, but it was just pure noise. We didn't hear a single word. So whoever that was is going to have to make a change before he makes his next transmission. N2EO, you got it, Rich. K2RAW.
Okay, thank you. N2EO. Well, thank you, everybody. And by the way, well, you really can't talk business on ham radio. But I could say, Andy is very competent. He's got the right type of equipment. I can tell, because I used to be a service tech, and I used to own a Bird 43, and an antenna analyzer. I know how to use them, so I can see Andy's doing a good job. I recommend them to anybody. By the way, Dick, where am I going to get that capacitor? Variables. Do Andy have it, or do I have to order it?
With the conversation I had with Andy, he has already begun the process of finding the model number of the variable capacitor. I think he's got the operating manual or the owner's manual for the antenna tuner. So he's searching that down. Don't worry about it. So he'll find it, the exact one, or a near substitute. As long as you put a capacitor of roughly the same number of picofarads with roughly the same voltage rating or higher, it'll work in that circuit. It's not a super critical component, if you know what I mean. I don't think it has to track another item, because I think your antenna tuner is a manual one. I don't think it's an automatic one, but I might be wrong on that. That almost doesn't matter in either case. So don't worry, that's being searched out as it is. And there's even a slim possibility that some repair of the current one is possible. We'll find out about that. And so when it comes to Andy, the B2CDL, if you ever visit his QTH, he has a garage full of test equipment. He's got a basement full of test equipment, all on shelves, ready to be used. So he's extremely well-equipped. Okay, let's see if we have... I'll put out one more call if anyone else has a question or a comment for the TechNet. Give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-ray Mike, Rich, and yes.
Good job. I think I heard Whiskey Golf 2 Golf X-ray Mike, Whiskey something, and I heard KE2EJ. Let me go over to Eric first. KE2EJ, what subject would you like to talk about, Eric? K2RIW.
Just a question, actually. Did you actually have any surface mount components? I'm looking for a 2-puff, probably a 4 or 6 size tip capacitor. I found the problem with the RF link, and the VCO is actually at the end of its tuning range, so sometimes it kicks in, and most of the time it kicks in, but sometimes it doesn't lock. And there was a 4.7 puff capacitor. It's a modified Colpitt, which goes to a little trimmer. So, I put in I have a 2-puff disc around it, but I'm looking for a single tip capacitor, and I'll probably order it from DigiKey. I just didn't, you know, I'd like to be done with it now.
Now, when I was actively working, the place I worked at had a great big stock of surface mount capacitors and resistors. I don't own any, I'm sorry to say. Now, the fact that you own a disc ceramic capacitor of the right number of picofarads, even though physically it'll look ugly, there's all kinds of ways you can mount it in there, and it'll give you a very reliable operation electronically of that circuit. It doesn't have to be a surface mount. So as long as you're using the right kind of optical amplifying device, in your case it's a loop, but in my case it would be a stereo microscope. With a stereo microscope, you'd have no trouble carefully bending the leads on a disceramic 4.7 picofarad capacitor and putting across the two lands where the surface mount component is supposed to go. So it doesn't have to be pretty. And if you glue it down, it'll even be physically strong, if you know what I mean. And your disceramic capacitor probably has a much higher voltage rating than the surface mount one that was there that has failed, particularly with part of the transmitter. Maybe you don't want to use the original one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, that's K2EJ.
I already have a little bit ceramic.
It's a little Chinese one. I was only concerned about, I don't know whether it's an NPO or what it is. And I know that the temperature coefficients of most of the surface mount stuff is right where I want it to be. The reason why I had to change the cap is because it's a commercial radio, this stuff, and it's designed to go rather wide frequency swings. It's just that at the point where it begins to lock, it's at the minimum of the capacitor. I can pull a slug out or the stator out and just not be quite close enough to resonance to bring the VCO a little bit down. I put the ceramic cap in there, and it works fine. I'm just concerned about temperature variation, that's all.
The previous surface mount capacitor, do you believe it failed? Is that the reason why you went out of the tuning range of that VCO, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, the capacitor is fine. It's just that you calculate the actual maximum resonance frequency based upon the coil that's in there. It's just a little bit too low, so I had to make the cap a little bit smaller.
Okay. If I understand you correctly, you're taking a commercial piece of equipment, moving it slightly to an amateur radio frequency, because you're using it, what do they say now, off-brand? You're using it at a slightly different frequency range, therefore that's part of the reason you're running out of range on the VCO for the phase lock loop. Is that true? Go ahead.
The way they design these boards, they break it up into bands. So, you put in five puffs that you're going to be, say, at 400, and you put in four puffs that you're going to be, say, 415. There's a chart, actually, that they have. So, it was actually very low, and I had to move it up.
But if you've got a disc ceramic that does the job, and you can mount it in there and glue it down so it's physically strong and it'll survive some vibration, I don't see any real need for you to put in the surface mount that you think you need. What makes you think that the disc ceramic you put in, which is working now electronically, what's wrong with leaving it that way as long as you glue it down so that it doesn't vibrate and fall off? Eric, go ahead.
Nothing. I was just concerned about the temperature coefficient of the capacitor. And the reason it kind of clued me in is because this cap actually gives me a little bit, even though it's moved up, gives me a little wider range. I'm looking for a sample voltage of, say, 6 volts, and it, as I move it down in frequency, the voltage gets higher. If I move it up in frequency, the voltage gets lower. I can't get exactly 6 volts, but I suppose I could just make myself happy and put a heat gun on the thing and hit it with some freeze spray and make sure it doesn't move.
Yeah, as I see it, the temperature coefficient of a capacitor that's part of a voltage-controlled oscillator, that's part of a phase-lock loop, whether it's an NPO, a positive or a negative, almost doesn't matter, as long as it doesn't shift so far that you no longer oscillate on the right frequency. The phase-lock loop will take care of the change in capacitance, if you know what I mean. So, you choose the right size of capacitor, I think you'll be able to get to the center of the tuning range that you're looking for, and therefore you'll have the maximum variability of the system versus temperature, and the heat gun idea is the right idea. If it keeps operating with your heat gun and your cold spray, you've got it made. So, although it's prettier with the surface mount capacitor, I don't think you've got to go through all the rigmarole of making it a surface mount. You've got something that might actually be better in the big picture. Over to you for any further comments, Eric. These are a bunch of opinions on my part. You do a lot more repairs than I do. KE2EJ, KQIW.
Beach, Roy Y with a comment.
Okay, Eric first and then Joe in that order. Go ahead, Eric.
Sorry, WK2J. Well, actually, there's very little room because it's on the bottom side of the board, and the whole board is encased so that way it's weatherproof. And also, if you try to operate the board without the case, the frequency goes way in the wrong direction. And then, of course, when you put the bottom cover on, the thing moves where you want it to be. So, it was a really tight fit. I actually had to trim the leads all the way down to the ceramic to keep the additional lead inductance, because I tried tacking a cap on there with the leads a little bit too long, and it told me, go away. So I chiseled it down to where the lead actually comes out of the ceramic, folded them in the right direction, and interestingly enough, the coil circuit, if you lay the cap down, it's way too far off frequency. If you stand the cap up and I just make it, it just fits, and I put a little dip of hot glue on there, and it ain't going anywhere.
Yeah, this is on the bottom of the PC board, and there's a very small spacing between it and the metallic cover when that's installed. You might want to be double darn sure to put a piece of so-called fish paper on that metallic cover to make sure nothing can touch it and create a short circuit. Let's see what Joe's got to say about all this. W2RYY, K2RIW, you got it, Joe.
W2RYY, I've taken a lot of different types of commercial radio equipment, especially Motorola, and modified it to go either down band or up band out of its normal frequency operating range. And one thing I have noticed, especially stuff that's synthesized, where you can look at the VCO, I try to make the thing work at least 20% higher in frequency, and I can tell if the thing is getting near the edge where it's going to go out of lock, either receive VCO or transfer VCO, by actually looking at the carrier frequency without any modulation on it, and see if you see a very high frequency signal on the VCO's frequency. And as you start approaching the thing and going out lock, you're going to start actually seeing this frequency get louder and louder. It's the steering voltage is biting. The phase lock loop is trying to pull, phase lock loop circuitry trying to pull it one way, and in some cases you can't go. But I find that it's getting to work at least 20% past the frequency range you want it to work in. When you bring it back to your operating frequency, you'll never have a problem with thing locking up anymore. It'll be right where it belongs, just like in the regular telecommercial band. Something else related to that, just a question for you, Eric. I know you're running with this. You're using some sort of Harris equipment. Are you running the low split, what they call the G-band 406 to 420 stuff, or are you running commercial stuff? Commercial stuff is normally meant to go like 440 or 450 to 470. Which type of equipment are you using? I know the frequencies you're operating on.
This is a low split. Actually, the way I have it right now, I'm pretty much in the center of its range. I'm only about 400 millivolts or off of where it should be. By the way, the loop filter on this thing is really tight, so, but it has a fast lock time. When I started to lower the capacity, when it finally got to the point where it locked, it was really sitting on the edge of where the filter was, so would swing back and forth a little bit and lower the cap a little more, and I can go about 20 megahertz up and 20 megahertz down, and it's pretty happy before it's unlocked, so I think I'm okay.
Okay, nothing further than that. W2 Roy Roy.
Again? Was that you, Roy?
Nope, it wasn't me.
Who said something? Okay, we're trying to get back to Mr. GXM. Go right ahead, Rich, I think it is. And I've forgotten your prefix. Over to you, GXM.
Thank you, Dick. This is Rich. Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray Mike. Now, I've been looking at the MFJ16010 tuner. This is an L tuner. It has a switched inductor in series with the antenna, and at the antenna connector it has a parallel variable capacitor. This tuner is meant to
attached to a random wire antenna, and it says it can accept transmit power up to 200 watts. Am I correct in assuming that this tuner